Hey friends, I'm Zen Hess, and we are back for another episode of Summer School. This is a short season of Currents in Religion, a podcast from Baylor's Religion Department and from Baylor University Press. This season has episodes about what it's like to be on a Bible translation committee and how to do interviews for historical research. We have episodes discussing how Baylor faculty are nurturing connections between psychologists, philosophers, and religion scholars, and about how scholars are thinking about environmental ethics with the Apostle Paul. In this episode, we're talking with three religious studies scholars about their writing process. Happy listening. Honestly, you're getting a heck of a deal out of this episode because it's really three episodes in one. You're going to hear three different conversations from three outstanding scholars each in different seasons of their careers. They discuss various aspects of the writing process. And since I am just about to start writing my dissertation, I am very happy to receive all of the insights that I gained from these interviews, and I bet you will be too. Let us know which bits were most helpful to you, or share your own writing strategies with us on Twitter at CIRBaylor. Here's conversation number one with Dr. Alicia Myers, who earned her PhD in New Testament here at Baylor, and she is now Associate Professor of New Testament and Greek at Campbell Divinity School. Dr. Alicia Myers, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So you have described writing as a vocation. Say a bit more about what that means to you.
Yeah, I talk about writing as a calling. It's something I've always loved to do ever since I was really little. I just have enjoyed it. I was kind of a nerd. I mean, when you're a nerd, you're just a nerd the whole time. But, you know, we had like this really old Encyclopedia Britannica books at home. And so I thought it was cool in the summer to like pick a topic and like learn about it and then write a report for myself, apparently, because no one.
Okay.
No one
that's nerdy. Yeah. Good.
That's very nerdy. But, you know, they were long days. I had practice in the morning and practice in the afternoon, but in the middle of the day, I had nothing to do. So I've always liked to write. And, you know, when you receive encouragement, it helps. So, and then, you know, I didn't grow up in a particularly churchy Christian home. But as I, you know, went to college and realized, oh, there's Christians who don't think women ought to do these things, which for me was astounding.
Yeah.
You know, writing was a place that I excelled. And like, I'm happy to like exchange ideas and get feedback and stuff, but it was like, it was a space I could make for myself. Whereas like no one was going to make a space for me in a pulpit, right?
Sure.
But in the writing, like the writing is going to stand on its own. And it's like, you get to write the beginning, the middle, and the end and put it out there and see what happens. Right. And if somebody publishes it, then it's out there. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't have to wait for somebody down the road to decide that I could preach one Sunday. And not only that, it stays out there, you know, for good and for ill, but it stays out there. Right. So for me, it's a place where I could have a voice.
Yeah.
And you know, get constructive feedback and find a community. And then also help my students figure out that they also have a voice. So with students, a lot of times, especially when they're first learning exegesis, so you'll get to this point, they're so terrified. They're like, I'm not an expert. I can't do this. And so they'll give you, I call it a collage or a pastiche of like all these quotes. I'm like, that's great that you read all these sources. I'm very proud of you. Where's your voice? And so helping students, because I'm like, you're never going to teach this way. Like you'd never preach like this.
Yeah.
So where's your voice in here? Who mm-hmm. do you actually agree with and why or disagree with? So that's also part of it. So me being active as a writer and continuing to ask myself those questions helps me to ask them of my students in an authentic way.
Yeah.
So
I love that.
And it's very important to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if I recall correctly, you also sometimes write for things like Working Preacher too, right? Yeah. Does your scholarship, mm-hmm. your writing as a vocation extends both to the students with whom you work and the academy of which you are a part, but also to the church.
Yeah. So I write pretty regularly when I can for Working Preacher. And part of this is, I mean, it just depends on the institution you work at, if these mm-hmm. kind of things count or not.
Yeah.
I work at a really small school and nothing counts or doesn't count. Like, I'll be just honest. They're yeah. thrilled.
Yeah.
It's great. It's all good. So it means I get to choose what I do. Uh-huh. So I can write for Working Preacher or for some of these smaller journals that have kind of a pastoral yeah. audience. And they're perfectly happy for me to use my time doing that and not always focusing on what's the next University Press book you've got coming out or whatever.
Sure. Very cool.
And it's good because it keeps you grounded.
Yeah.
But I'd say don't just write for those.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you won't have your grounding on the other side. It's trying to have a balance, I think.
Yeah. So let's talk about the work of writing. Tell us about your idea stage. How do you know when you've landed on a question or an idea worth writing about?
So here, mostly, it's just reading all the time, right? So you're reading in your primary texts, whatever they happen to be at the moment. Mm-hmm. And you're asking questions.
Yeah.
So just got to keep track of those questions. I have a file that's all just ideas.
Oh, cool.
And I've had it for years and I just add to it. I can change them. But it might be a terrible idea, but I'm still going to write it down because it might turn into something.
Uh-huh.
And then it's kind of like if the idea sticks with me, like if it's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps getting triggered by the other stuff I'm reading. Like if you're reading all the time, stuff will get hit all the time. So reading primary texts closely, asking questions, and then reading secondary literature and seeing if you're like, are they answering the question that you're asking? Have they left something really out? Would you answer it in a different way? All of those kind of things.
Yeah.
I think the most unique thing that I've done would be my motherhood book. And it was just like, oh, people like to talk about the idea of motherhood, but no one's actually gone back to medical literature to figure out where people think babies came from or what uh-huh. breast milk is. So I'm like, I'm just going to read that stuff. So it's just finding the gaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if it inspires you, like if it's an idea that you can stick with, you may have like a really great idea, but if it's boring for you, don't do it.
Yeah, for sure.
It needs to be life-giving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious too, just from your reflections on being a teacher and on your kind of desire to walk alongside students in the writing process and their writing development and maturity. Do you feel like you've had many ideas that have kind of generated out of the classroom?
Oh, so I'm okay. There's two other New Testament people on faculty where I work.
Okay.
But they are the dean and the associate dean.
Okay.
Which means I'm functionally the only New Testament person on faculty because they're administrating an entire school.
Yeah.
Which means I have been here. I'm about to start my 10th year. I have taught at least one new class every year that I've been here.
Wow.
So I've had one brand new prep every year that I've been here.
That's a lot.
So yeah, it's a lot, but it makes you stay fresh. If you're going to do your work well, you have to read. So yeah. I just taught a class on Matthew. I'm not a Matthew person. By the gospel I know least about, which is also part of the reason why we're doing Matthew. Because
yeah.
I need to spend some time with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had ideas in there, like as I was prepping for class. So just put them in the file.
Yeah.
Just keep track of them. And I may not be able to write about them right now or in the next couple of years, but sometime down the road, maybe I will.
Yeah.
So for sure, It's amazing to watch students hit on ideas mm-hmm. in class. They're like, oh, that's the thing. That's the one I want to do, and watch them develop their own ideas. That's been really fun. Yeah. So I try to be very careful to let students own their own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and just to give them resources and ask them questions. But you know, you never want to like steal somebody else's ideas.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you're like, so in the prepping and in the conversation, you have an idea and you just jot it down in your notes,
right,
or you keep it in your file or whatever. But yeah, just seeing where students go is,
yeah,
it's really cool. Sometimes it's like, no, get out of that. But sometimes it's amazing. You just watch them. You watch them go. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us just a little bit more about your idea document. Are we talking like, like a sentence or a paragraph or a page?
I'm gonna open it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us some samples.
So, okay. I'm married to a computer guy. So I have a very like organized file system on my computer because nice. That's, you know, thanks. So I've got to dig deep here. Publication ideas dot doc. All right. It's just a list right now. Yeah. It's just a list. Sometimes I write like a few sentences, like, the more you write, the more you gain a reputation as somebody who writes. Uh-huh. And so what's going to happen to you is people will ask you to write on things. And so that's something I'm working with right now, is like, how do I continue to have a research agenda and balance the being asked to write on things?
Yeah.
But so you'll be asked to write on the death of Jesus in the Gospel of John. Mm-hmm. So you will just start an idea database for that and write a few sentences and say, okay, well, I could take it this way or this way. And then your editor will say, oh, I like that one. Let's do that one. So, I don't know. I write them down. I also write them in like my notes for classes. I don't like to lose stuff. I think that's from studying with Charles Talbert. So I've got like a binder for each class, and then I take notes. Like especially the first time you ever teach a class, take notes right after you finish that class session and say, okay, this worked.
Right.
This thing I did not work. We are not doing that again.
Yeah.
Right. And, but also if you keep notes of like, that's the idea I had while I was doing that research.
Yeah. Smart.
Yeah. Just a few sentences. Yeah. I found one the other day that I had made for, I think it was for Matthew stuff from this past semester. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So once you've got an idea, or once maybe an idea has been given to you by someone who wants you to write an essay, what does your process look like from there?
Well, it depends on what it is. So, if it's really rooted in a passage, if I'm like, I'm starting from scratch here and I really just want to get into the text, I have a little sheet that my undergraduate professor, this is how he taught exegesis, and it's four columns. I still use it with my students. The first column is the verse.
Okay.
So you just plunk in the verse, right? Mm-hmm. So plunk in the Greek, plunk in your translation, whatever you want. And then the next is observations. So just what's in the verse?
Yeah.
It seems dumb, but just write it down. Jesus cried, right?
Yeah.
like what's the verb? And then questions.
Sure.
Questions you have about it. And then inferences. My inference bubble is usually pretty blank until I get farther on in the passage.
Okay.
And that's where I start. I did that this past, I came back from Greece and I was like, well, you got to write an article on John too. how are we going to start this? That's how I started that. And it's just close observation. So I just made an observation chart is what I call it. And it's just full of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually will hit on something, because you'll finish it and you'll go back and be like, okay, what's the thing that kept popping up?
Yeah.
Or what's the question that really drove me to go look at an additional contemporaneous source, and then you just start chasing from there.
Yeah. So do you go from that document where you've named some questions, you've made some observations, and you've kind of found a trail? Are you moving from that into like commentary reading and then out to secondary literature journals? Do you have like a method for that kind of essay? Or is it more like you've got a hunch from having read and made observations, and you start to try to articulate that hunch before you kind of let other voices in? How does that work?
So usually the stuff I'm doing is a lot of comparative literature work. So mm-hmm. I don't want to jump to the secondary too soon, because yeah. they'll tell me what other primary sources to use, right? And then yeah. all of a sudden I've got their primary sources in my head instead of my own.
Yeah.
So for this one, I was looking at like, what is the conflagration? And this is something you'll have ideas that you've been nursing in your head. So I've just finished a book on the theology of the Gospel of John. And in the midst of that research, I was reading another book about, like, I've been curious about purity and impurity for several years now with some stuff I was doing on 1 John. So it's like trailing. Uh-huh. And so Jesus coming in the temple, I'm like, okay, what is happening here with this sort of contact between holy and profane? Yeah. So that's something that I've been chasing for a little while. So I just wanted to get into that. So I read through John, but then I read through a bunch of Old Testament passages where holiness meets the profane, but then also, you know, Second Temple Jewish texts. And I spent more time there, though there's a bunch of Greco-Roman materials where you can go as well. So I actually, for that one, I sat down with Second Maccabees for a good long time.
Yeah.
Because there's some really good stories there, like Heliodorus walking into the and he says, like, don't go into the treasury. I'm going to go. And he just gets the crap beat out of him, uh-huh. right? He's almost beaten to death. And the only reason he's spared is because Onias comes back and does the sacrifice on his behalf. Well, that is a great example of like the violence that happens when holiness meets the profane. And then there's more in yeah. Second Maccabees. So I sat with that a while. And then I moved to secondary literature.
Okay.
Because if I go too soon to the secondary literature, the question is, who are you surrendering the conversation to?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I have.
Now you have to use it. You have to go, because somebody else may have already written that monograph, and then you're like, well.
You're listening to Currents in Religion, and we're talking with Alicia Myers.
So you're telling us a little bit about, like, you're going to these various primary sources. As you're reading along, a bunch of my colleagues have fellow students and others have asked how to take notes for writing, right? Like how to like organize and how to strategically take notes so that the things we've read are still kind of at our fingertips if we don't have that steel trap memory that we all wish we had.
Yeah. So when I'm at my best, which is not always. So all the thing is like, I know a system that's really good, but sometimes your system won't work for you. So we'll get back to that. But when I'm at my best, I make a file and I organize it by themes mm-hmm. or type of writing. So the other thing that I'm working on right now is a presentation, and I'm looking at the huperites they're huperitai because they're multiple, in John 7.
Okay.
Well, people translate this word as temple police all the time. And it's a super common word, but they're very infrequent characters in John. So no one's spent a lot of time with, like, well, what are these people?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. I have a file that's just like uses. Like, so, and you have to get creative. If you work at a small institution like I do, you have to get creative with how you search primary sources. Because I don't have, my institution doesn't have a subscription to TLG.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So you got to get creative. And that could be a podcast on itself. What do you do when you get hired by a small school? Because that's where most of y'all are going to end up.
Yeah, right.
What does that mean when you're not at the research institution anymore? But I've just been going through uses. So I just have a file that's just, okay, here we go. Here's the noun. Mm-hmm. And then I just have it split up by like Greco-Roman, certain time period, Second Temple Jewish, certain time periods, New Testament, Septuagint. And I just have notes, and then I'll have like, okay, that's that noun. What about the verb? Right.
Yeah.
Right. Huperateo. Okay. Let's go look at that. Okay. Well, there's another noun form that just means service.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just chasing that down. But if you do not take notes, you're screwed.
Yeah.
You just have to, it's annoying. It's tedious. You may not use half those references, but if you do not write them down, you're going to kick yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I did that before I went and used the TDNT. Like I did my own stuff before I went back. Because, and then when I read his little thing, I was like, that's not really what that one meant.
Uh-huh.
Like, and you only know that if you've gone through. So I just do, I take notes. I try to organize it by contents. If I'm reading through a bunch of commentaries, I'll just have a section named commentaries and I'll just put it. And I put the full bibliographic reference right there.
Yeah.
Cause then all I have to do is cut and paste.
Right.
I'll have to rewrite it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's work up front, but it'll help you in the end.
Right.
When I'm at my best, that's what I'm doing. But sometimes I'm not at my best. And then I'm writing by hand. Cause my brain is tired of looking at a screen.
Yeah. Fair enough.
That's and then not that's always a more bad
thing. Yeah, yeah, it's more work, but
you better know what notebook you wrote it in.
So what about writing itself? So you've done research, you've done your note taking, you've got your idea. Are you writing kind of as you go this whole time? Like, are you trying to write through to sort out ideas, or do you start writing after you feel like you know what you need to say? And what does your writing process actually look like?
I don't write until I feel like, I talk about it, I'm like, I'm full. There's no more room. I got to get some stuff out before I can put more stuff in.
Yeah.
So I have to get to a point where I start feeling like, especially because at that point you're reading through secondary sources, if you feel like everyone's saying the same thing, once mm-hmm. you get that point, and you've got your major voices. Though I will say, don't get caught up in who's always a major voice, because then you start reading stuff and you're like, oh, everybody just cites Boltman, Hoskins, and Dodd.
Yeah.
Well, great. These guys have been gone for a while. Like, let's branch it out. But once I start feeling like, okay, everybody's kind of saying the same thing, and they're not saying the same thing that I want to say, and then I will start writing. I usually make an outline, a short outline of sorts, and then I kind of fill it in. I hate writing introductions. I don't know who likes them,
right?
But I hate writing them. So I usually will just write the intro really, really fast and know that it's garbage, and then I'll come back and fix it later.
Nice.
So I just get something on the page so then I can get to my first main section. And then, like, I have an outline, but you have to be flexible because you may realize your argument is going in a different way than you anticipated.
Yeah.
And I will just go chunk by chunk. I try not to stop at the end of the day with a section, like not stop at a neat end. I try to stop at a jagged end where I've got some, like a sentence, like, I've got three paragraphs left. This one's about this. This one's about that. This one's about that. So that way, when I come back the next day, I'm like, okay, I'm not like, oh shoot, what was this paragraph supposed to be about? So, you're not starting from scratch every day.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's like, you've got you're leaving a marker for where you were thinking to go and when you were in the headspace that you'd been in while you were writing.
Right.
Nice.
I used to, when I first started writing, like, be really careful about having my footnotes complete as I wrote. I don't do that anymore.
No,
because it disrupts your train of thought. If you're trying to, you're just like, you know that those people said that.
Yeah.
So you just put the footnote and you're like, the people that say this. And then I just leave it highlighted. Like, if I know it offhand and I'm like, bup, bup, bup. And I'm, because sometimes you aren't going to write content well, but you're in a footnote mood. You can do your footnotes that day.
Yeah.
And do that then. But if you're in idea mode,
right,
don't keep shifting gears on your brain. because you will lose that idea.
Yeah.
Because you were busy putting semicolons in your footnote. don't do that.
Nice.
So,
and do you, you know, there's the self-help book, self-help writing books are always like, write every single day. Do you have any kind of strategies like that? I mean, you're teaching, you're doing new course prep. How are you fitting writing in to your schedule?
I can't write every day. It just doesn't work. Okay. So I get the methodical, I get that. I was an athlete. I get it. You got to go to practice. I get it. But you cannot forget the artistic side of what we do.
Yeah.
In the creative side of what we do. And so there's a bit of you, you're going to have to hit when the iron is hot.
Right.
And you're going to have, for me, I have to pay attention to when the flow hits.
Yeah.
And sometimes that flow is going to be influenced by when deadlines exist, right? You just got to,
yeah,
that's real. But sometimes I will have really, really late nights. I generally do not have early mornings, but there's certain, my time of day that's best shifts throughout the year.
Oh, interesting.
So I have to be aware of that. And I've learned not to fight it.
Uh-huh.
And then when I'm planning my schedule, during the semester, I'm fortunate to teach graduate students.
Yeah.
My colleagues who teach undergrad, it's a different game because you're teaching a 4-4 and you may be in the classroom every single day.
Right.
And you have to figure out 2 hours that you could block somewhere and you're going to have to make it work.
Yeah.
Right. I teach Monday, Tuesday, Thursdays.
Okay.
We often have committee meetings on Wednesdays, but that means Friday is mine.
Yeah.
And so I just protect that sucker because I know for me, large chunks of time work best. Sometimes it'll take me an hour to get my brain back, which is again, why I leave a sentence or something.
Yeah.
So that's what I've done. And then when I finish something, I have to take a break. It's like you've exhausted the muscle and it needs time to recover.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you keep using it and you never take a break. So Sharon Dowd she was there for the first 2 years. I think I was there. She was like, if you don't take a break at the end of the semester, you're just setting yourself up to be fried.
Yeah.
There'll be nothing left.
Yeah.
And you have to have other things that feed you in your life.
That's wise counsel.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that I probably can guess the answer to this question, but there is some debate around whether you ought to just write, or edit while you write.
Mm-hmm.
Do you edit while you write, or do you just try and get a lot of content? I mean, I know what you said about your introduction. Does that hold for the first main section, or are you writing and polishing as
Sometimes. So it's funny for me. It feels tangled.
That's sure.
Sad. I talk about feelings, I guess. But if something feels really knotty and really tangled, it's not clear, mm-hmm. I have to go back and sort it. Because then I don't know what my path is. How do I keep writing if I don't know which way I'm actually going here?
Yeah.
So I will sometimes get, I was finishing a chapter with for this book that Mandy and I are doing, Dr. McMichael and I are doing. And I was like, I've got it outlined. This is the way I'm going to go. I'm going to go by passage. It's going to be so perfect. I get about halfway through that chapter. I'm like, this is garbage. It cannot be organized this way. It just can't. But yeah. I had to mess up. I had to get to the point where I saw that this was not going to work. So it was not a waste of time. But I realized I had to go back and reorganize it.
Yeah.
And for me, I cannot continue once I know if I keep going, I'm at a dead end.
Yeah.
So I will just get the intro down because I hate that sucker and it's never going to be good until you know what you've written anyway. So just bleh.
Yeah.
And then, I will start trucking a little ways, but then I will feel it out. Does it feel smooth? Does it feel like one idea is progressing to the next? I have all my content. I have an outline already. I know where I want to go. At least I think I do.
Yeah.
But if I'm get stuck in a knot, I have to go back and sort it. And I have it with everything I write. There's that is a guaranteed stage of everything I've ever written, I have been like, this is trash. This is garbage. Chuck it.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have to get to the other side of that where you see like which thread you actually need to pull to get that knot out.
Yeah.
And then I can go toward the end. Now, sometimes when I'm at the end, you're like, I'm tired, but sometimes there's some days you just have to push through and you're like, this isn't going to be the best, but it's going to be a conclusion. And then I leave it. I got to leave it for several days to a week to where I'm not emotionally connected to it anymore so that I can stand back and say, is this actually what this says? Is this what I mean to say?
Mm-hmm.
Have I learned something subsequent to the time I finished this?
Yeah.
But that's how I do it.
Your story of having had a structure in mind and then getting into the essay and realizing that it wasn't going to work. It reminds me of a book that I've been reading. It was actually, I was at NABPR this year and it was recommended in the panel on scholars doing kind of public facing scholarship, but it's called Stylish Academic Writing by Helen Sword.
Cool.
Yeah. And she describes, I think she's drawing from someone else, but she describes writing as like building a house. She says, you know, the sentences are bricks, but the paragraphs, they're walls and windows. And sometimes editing requires, you know, patching up some of the bricks, but there's really wrenching days where writing requires you the sake of your project, for your building, to bring a wrecking ball in and just to knock the whole thing down and start over. Yeah.
What I do to make myself feel better. Right? Because I'm like, nothing's wasted. I will save a copy of the garbage version.
Nice.
So you just keep it. It's in a file somewhere over there. So you didn't just throw it all away. Because there might be something good that comes out of it. But yeah, no.
Oh, that's good. I delete mine so no one will ever find it and see it.
Really?
No, I don't.
For everything I write, I have a file that says like the article's name edits or the chapter's name edits. And it's like all the junk. And then I usually have one version that I finished and then I have to go back and shorten it. They start giving you word limits.
Yeah.
And so then I'll have the article's name shortened, which will end up being the final one.
There you go. Yeah. I have a from my seminars, you could go through basically any of my folders that keep all of my seminar work in them. And for almost every seminar paper that I've written, there's a like final paper draft one.
Exactly.
And it's an introduction that's not finished. And then I've got paper draft two, and it's an introduction and maybe the first paragraph of the first section. And then paper draft three is normally where I've sorted out, because I don't do what you do with introductions. I just obsess over them. And it's the least efficient thing. I've got to stop doing that. But that's, so you can find these stub paper one, paper two, and then I've got paper draft three. And then the final paper is where like I copy paper draft three over and make the final kind of pass through. And then I've got kind of the progression of it. But tell us about any resources that you think would be useful to our listeners who would like to improve their own writing.
I always tell people, to become a better writer, read good writers.
Yeah.
So, and read them of all sorts. Mm-hmm. It's just like I have students who want to be better preachers. I'm like, well, then listen to good preachers. Don't listen to some terrible. You need some names? I got some names. go listen to these people. But it's the same thing. So it depends on the genre that you're working with. But there's certain scholars who I'm like, I actually enjoy not only the idea you're presenting, but the way in which you've presented it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be different for everybody. For me, Jennifer Glancy is a very good writer.
Cool.
I enjoy what she's doing, but she also, like, especially her second book was really good. Corporal Knowledge. Mm-hmm. It was really good. But like for me, Craig Kester is great to read because Craig is super clear. He's also a great editor. Like he's just a really clear thinker.
Yeah.
And so he's a clear writer.
Right.
Katrin Williams, I also think is a very good, writer. But there's so many.
Yeah.
But there's some scholars, you know, like they have a great idea, but you're slogging it. But I would say find people whose writing you like and try to figure out why. Like, what is it about that style that resonates with you?
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the idea.
Right.
And other people, like, you know, it's just, you know, it's not, and give grace to, I mean, I'm going to say this right now, give grace to everybody. If you're reading their revised dissertation, is that dissertation was, you know, y'all doing it. That dissertation was less about their voice than it was about a committee.
Right.
So like, you cannot, like, you got to recognize the genres that you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's second book is, I feel like, where you'll get a sense of who they are, because it's like their freedom book.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then just read different stuff, read different types of writing.
Yeah.
If I were really good, I would also read a lot of fiction. I just don't anymore, because sure, that's not how I relax. I relax in, I color mandalas a lot. That's what I do to relax. Cause it's,
cool.
I don't want words anymore.
Uh-huh.
For words. Yeah, that's what I would say.
That's great advice. Dr. Alicia Myers, it's been so fun talking to you. Thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I hope it was helpful.
And now here is my conversation with Dr. Amos Yong, who is a Baylor Press author and professor of theology and mission at Fuller Seminary. Dr. Amos Yong, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Glad to be here.
So you are a prolific author, and one of the most important things about writing is having something to write about. How do you know when you've stumbled into a good question or a good idea?
The easiest way for me to respond to the question is just to simply sort of tell the short story of my own journey into academia and, you know, into being a theologian, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up in a Pentecostal family, Pentecostal preacher's kid. Went to Pentecostal undergraduate college. Didn't really get turned on theologically until going to seminary. And when I was right after I finished seminary, I attended for the first time the Society for Pentecostal Studies in 1994, where I got to experience other Pentecostal academics. And that suggested to me that, you know, that's probably something that might be on my part of my journey. And I went to a PhD program. I was inspired to think Pentecostally, so to speak, in that.
Yeah.
In through those experiences. And I turned to then developing one of the questions that had begun emerging for me in those years, which is, well, what might a Pentecostal say theologically about religious pluralism?
Mm-hmm.
That was the dissertation topic. And the way in which my writing has really gone from that point on is really following that question. What might a Pentecostal theologian say about anything? Simply because, you know, Pentecostal theological reflection by the mid-1990s was just barely beginning to emerge.
Okay.
And, you know, there weren't very many Pentecostal theologians. I mean, the whole point of Pentecostal and theology, that was sort of an oxymoron up until,
mm-hmm.
well, maybe even not too long ago, right? So when we ask the question, well, what might a Pentecostal theological perspective be on X? Pick your pick, whatever X is. There hasn't been a Pentecostal theological perspective on X.
Right. So your good ideas were by default anything that considered what Pentecostal theologians might think about anything.
Might think about anything. Exactly. That, okay. that was 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So almost 30 years ago. And certainly now, almost 30 years later, and there are a lot more Pentecostal theologians and
yeah, absolutely.
A lot more, you know, topics that Pentecostal theologians have written on. But when I was first starting out, literally, what does a Pentecostal think about X could have been anything. And I I therefore, you know, all those questions that I had about what I might think of as a theologian was really, how might I think Pentecostally about this? And I just started writing books and, you know, just being naturally curious, and the questions just kept coming and people just kept asking, and I just felt like I could just keep writing. So
interesting. So you just mentioned these two things at the end there. Questions just kept coming is one thing, and people just kept asking is another. So tell me a little bit more about questions just keep coming. Like what's sort of your way of generating these questions? Is it just to sit in a quiet room and read a lot? Is it conversation? Is it all of it?
All of it, right? I mean, regularly attending the Society of Pentecostal Studies over the decades, or attending AAR. I remember when I was getting ready to apply for my first sabbatical, mm-hmm. 6 years after my PhD, and a question my mother asked me when I got my dissertation published, the dissertation that I told you about. That was my mm-hmm. first book, right? So when I was pretty excited, I told that to my mom, hey, Mom, I've got my dissertation published. And her question to me at that time, this was over 20 years ago, was, well, when are you going to write a book about Mark? Now, Mark is my brother. Is Down syndrome.
Okay.
And so I didn't answer her question at the time, but 6 years later, when I was thinking about a topic for my research for my sabbatical, mm-hmm. that question came back, you know, and when am I going to write a book about Mark? Or what am I going to write? That was a question. What does a Pentecostal think about disability mm-hmm. theologically? And so my first book on theology and disability came out of responding to my mom's invitation to think about a book about Mark. And a few years later, a good friend of mine, James K. A. Smith, who I'm sure you and others listening to this would know, mm-hmm. Was challenging me to, you know, I'd written books on theology of religions, my book on disability, a book on Pentecostal theology. And he'd been doing quite a bit of work on public theology, I think, as we know. You know, this was in the mid-2000s. And he said, well, you know, Pentecostals really need to think about how they engage the polis, the public square, the mm-hmm. political. And so when I got an invitation to give the Cadbury lectures at the University of Birmingham in 2008, mm-hmm. I thought to myself, hey, yeah, what would a Pentecostal theologian say about the political? And so I gave them my lectures, which then got published later on as In the Days of Caesar, Pentecostalism and Political Theology. So it's those kinds of things that, you know, invitations and prompts. And then recognizing that, if nobody's written a book on it before, then the field's pretty wide open. And this, you know.
So, okay. That's a little bit about how you settle in on an idea. Once you've got that idea, what's your approach for starting research or conducting the research that helps you to write the book?
Yeah. So, you know, it took me a year of reading widely and broad, even though there weren't any Pentecostals who'd written anything on political theology or public theology by, you know, that time, 2006, 7, 8. As I think we all know, by 6, 7, 8, there was extensive, you know, literature on political theology, on public theology. So I read widely. It took me, I read widely. Usually it takes a year or two in a new area for me. And what I do is I'll take my notes onto a electronically.
Oh, okay.
Onto a Word document. I'll insert my footnotes to document where I got these ideas from, these sources. And for that book, I probably generated over 1,000 pages, single space, 12-point font of notes.
1,000 pages. Wow.
With maybe 800 references, right?
Okay.
800 footnotes or whatever, you know. And so, well, when you've got 1,000 pages, 500,000 words on a particular topic, then writing a 100,000-word book at that point is pretty easy, right? I mean, you know, you just got to sort of, it took me probably a month and a half to sort of reread everything, sort of digest my understanding of the field, and then be able to organize and sort out my thoughts and then get my Pentecostal sort of engagement with the literature and my own constructive Pentecostal sort of thinking and then reframing of all that. So, you know, that might be a 1-3 year process. I just recently published a theological commentary on the Book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. This one probably took me 2 or 3 years of reading in the literature. Revelation, as you well might imagine, it's just humongous. But and then Yeah, I generate, again, you know, generating literally hundreds of pages of single space notes. Mm-hmm. And then in this case, the organizational element was less complicated in, from the perspective that it was a chapter by chapter commentary. So I didn't.
Sure.
But I still needed to sort of figure out how, what did I think about the structure of Revelation from all the different options that were out there? Mm-hmm. Why would I engage or structure Revelation in this way? And then a few years of sort of reading in the field. That one probably took me about 3 or 4 months of, about 3 months of writing for the first draft.
Okay.
You know, 8 to 5, you know, 5 days a week.
Right.
When, you know, when you've got kids in school or out of school and house empty and on sabbatical. So that was, that's how that came about.
You're listening to Currents in Religion, and we're speaking with Amos Young. So it sounds to me like you do an extensive amount of reading before you do any writing, or are you kind of writing out some drafts of thoughts and ideas along the way?
I think it's mostly extensive amount of reading and note taking.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, what might emerge might be outlines.
Ah.
And then the outlines might be revised as the along mm-hmm. the way unfolds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point I'll review everything I've taken in notes, revisit my outline, and then figure out, okay, where are all these voices going to go in my argument? Where do I need them?
Right.
And then I write based upon that really developed outline, so that I know exactly, you know, how many chapters there are, how many sections in each chapter, what the arc of the argument is, you know, mm-hmm. you know, when author A shows up in chapter 2.3 and when author B shows up in chapter 7 points, whatever the case might be.
Sure, sure. So your note-taking kind of process is you reading and maybe outlining their articles too, or the books that you're reading, and kind of having a preliminary engagement with these figures so that you can kind of be thinking with them. It's not maybe simply copying out quotes into a document or something. There's probably some of that too, but this is really a process of wanting to hear what other people have said and to understand it, so that then when you move on to the writing stage, you can kind of think clearly about not only what's out there for you to work with, but how you understand it and how you would critique or respond or affirm to it.
All of the above, right?
Yeah.
So enough of the source. Well, obviously, you know, our notes are going to be motivated by our situatedness, perspective, angles, curiosities, questions, presuppositions, you know, those sorts of
course,
things.
Right? Yeah.
And as a Pentecostal, my own Pentecostal proclivities, my sort of pneumatological methodology that I've been developing over decades, those already shape where I read, who I read, how I read, what I observe. Right. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, when you're working in a new area, like the ones I've mentioned, it's also a means of really educating myself, so that if I'm going to speak into that area, then I need to understand where the conversation is at. So,
yeah.
You know, the notes will help me to process myself where the conversations emerge,
mm-hmm.
Leave me enough to know if I'm citing, John Doe A. Well, who is John Doe, and you know, where is he coming from, or she coming from in terms of the argument, so that if I do decide to reference or cite A, B, or C scholar, I'll have enough in my notes to be able to appropriately reference,
yeah,
and contextually appropriately reference. Right now, every once in a while, when I'm engaging with the work or when I'm writing, I might feel like, hey, you know, these notes that I've taken really are quite suggestive, and I might want to go back and revisit part of this text, because now that I'm actually in this space of really engaging the argument and writing out my own response, there's a lot there in that particular mm-hmm. source that maybe I want a more extended interaction with. And then I'll have to go, you know, either pull the book off my shelf or go back to the library, whatever the case might be. But enough to be able to provide enough context and enough to be able to situate these sources in their context and relative to my argument. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that, whenever I might, I think a first rule of thumb, whenever we cite somebody, make sure they recognize themselves and how they're being referred to.
That's a good bit of practical wisdom there. I like that. Okay, so tell us also now a little bit about the writing habits that you've alluded to. So if you had an ideal, it would be writing, or not necessarily an ideal, but you mentioned the book that came together in 3 months was you being able to sit down from 8 to 5. Given that I think most of our listeners don't have that as their normal scenario, what are some of your writing habits for being able to write in a really, you've been in administrative roles and different things for a while, so you're still writing while you're quite taxed by other tasks. How are you doing that?
Yeah, well, frankly, in the last few years, I haven't been doing as much writing. I've still had books coming out, but these were mainly, back for that Revelation commentary I wrote on my last sabbatical before I took on a senior administrative role more recently. There are going to be periods of time where the writing obviously goes down and whatever you might have put together before, as we know, academic texts sometimes take years, mm-hmm. even once a full manuscript is drafted, to actually appear.
Yeah.
But I've been blessed. I've had great support from, before I became an administrator, supportive deans, supportive department chairs, mm-hmm. Incredibly supportive spouse. And I've had the privilege of, receiving sabbaticals in over the last couple decades that have really helped. But yeah, otherwise it's wherever you can carve out the time, right? And sometimes it's I'm pretty early riser usually, and so mornings oftentimes I'll get a little bit done before the day kicks in and starts getting going. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's you take a couple hours at night to do those sorts of things. So
yeah,
just making sure that you keep pushing the idea forward, I think is important, because it makes it helps to, there's a kind of an inertia to an idea unfolding that so you get 30 minutes, 45 minutes, get another couple paragraphs in and just keep the idea going forward.
Yeah. Do you set some kind of goal as you're writing along? Like, how do you have a big project in mind? Do you break it down into smaller parts, or is it kind of just following the lead as it comes?
Well, I mean, that depends on, what kind of schedule that you can work out. Mm-hmm. And I think every writer has his or her own kind of approach here. I have found that, as the years have gone by, certainly I'm approaching many of my writing projects a little bit differently than when I first started. Obviously, there's an evolutionary dimension to how each one of us builds on our experience and so on and so forth. But I do find that if I can put together an afternoon, 3-4 hours, I can probably get, 1,000-1,500 words done. Mm-hmm. And so, when you then what I usually try to say to myself is, okay, what's the size of the book here that we're talking about?
Right.
And that size has, there are a lot of, a lot of factors that might influence a size. What was the idea that you're working with? What did you pitch to a publisher? What are they looking for? Mm-hmm. What is the audience? Is this a kind of initial groundbreaking kind of thing that needs a lot of footnotes in it? Are you writing for more, trying to write more accessibly? Mm-hmm. Are you writing a textbook? So, but the point is that, whatever it is, whether it's 50,000 words or 75,000 words or 100,000 words, I'll often say to myself, okay, given what I know about my next year, my next 9 months, my next 6 months, whatever the case might be, What are reasonable? And here's where, again, some of the things that, you know, life will impinge, but I've been relatively blessed over the course of the last couple of decades between the support I've received to be able to then anticipate and say, okay, I think I can get this manuscript done in 2 years,
mm-hmm.
which means that, in 1 year, I need to be at 40,000 words. And that means in 6 months, I need to be at 20,000 words. And again, so you just kind of go back and do your math. And if I know I'm going to have a sabbatical where I'm going to have, whatever amount of time that I know I'm going to be able to write more during that period, sometimes I'll get a summer writing month mm-hmm. and I'll know I can, you know, sit down from 8 to 4 and I can probably get 4,000 words in. And if I do 4,000 words a day, over 3 or 4 weeks, that's a small book.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. All right. Last question here. Are there any essential resources that you'd recommend to graduate students or early career scholars who want to improve their writing?
Yeah, just actually preparing for a PhD seminar I'm doing. I read a little work called They Say, I Say by Gerald Graff.
Okay.
And, it was handed to me on a syllabus that was used before that we're having our PhD students read. And after I worked through it a few months ago, I thought to myself, hey, this is really a nice, helpful little thing. And I even began to wonder and say to myself, I wonder if my writing itself would actually measure up to these principles here.
Yeah.
And so, take a look at that. If you want something more theologically reflective, I've got a short little book called Learning Theology, in which I try to present writing as a kind of spiritual practice as well. So,
great. Well, we'll check those things out. Dr. Amos Young, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And finally, enjoy this conversation on writing with style and substance with Christopher Hocklow-Tubby, who is Assistant Professor of Religion at Cornell College. His first book, Civilized Piety, which was published by Baylor University Press, received the Manfred Lautenschlager Award for Theological Promise. Dr. Hocklow-Tubby, thank you for joining us today on Currents in Religion.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So the folks at Baylor University Press gave you a high honor and described you as one of their authors who writes with style and substance. So tell us a bit about how you've come to be a stylish academic writer.
I love that honor, and I am so humbled by this. So much appreciations to my friends at Baylor University Press for thinking about me. I come at this, right, sincerely humbled, because I think all of us in academy, at least everyone who I have met, who I've just deeply respected for their intellect, struggle with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
We'll maybe talk about this. This ties into writing, right? That my writing is never good enough, or mm-hmm. it's never going to sound smart enough. Or what I think gets us in trouble in style is that, well, I need to punch this up and use more technical terms and use more jargon and longer sentences so that I can mask and camouflage and pass as being intelligent
mm-hmm.
versus just trusting in what I need to say and the process of writing and emphasizing the need for clarity and concision and coming across with the point that we want to get. So, if I've become a stylish writer, it is because of that deep insecurity. And also it's because of just invaluable friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And so you ask about the how. And when I think about the how, I think about my advisors at Harvard Divinity School, in particular, Laura Nasrallah and Karen King, who are fabulous and beautiful writers in of themselves. I also think about my colleague, Michelle Chaplin Sanchez, who also is a professor now at Harvard Divinity in Reformation Studies. You know, we came up together in the MDiv and the Doctor of Theology program. And when it came to writing papers and thinking about theoretical authors, she was always my go-to person who would oftentimes, you know, at least have one pass on some of my most important term papers or dissertation even at times. Mm-hmm. And I just thought she was such a lovely author. And so one of the ways in which I think my own style developed was giving my writing to people I really respected and then paying close attention to the kind of remarks and suggestions and comments that they gave. And believe me, my papers oftentimes came back with comments all across the column. And any student of Lord Nasrallah knows that you get this AWK, right? And that's just awkward, right? So awkward duckling papers all the time, right? Yeah. But that's how you grow. You think, oh, okay, I do see that this doesn't make sense, or it's jumping the page. Or I also remember this one comment, right? Because as you write history, it's always that balance of moving the argument along, or as mm-hmm. you introduce new pieces of information or new people, like Philo of Alexandria in my case, right? There's this temptation to move into a like Wikipedia mode of writing where it's like, well, sure. Philo of Alexandria, let me tell you all I know about him. Here's everything you need to know, right? And she would say, well, this is not a dictionary entry.
Yeah.
You know, you need to introduce him just enough that the reader doesn't feel lost with the relevancy of what he has to say to your argument, but you need to always keep it to your argument and make it flow.
Yeah.
And so I really credit, in terms of the process of how the people who have come along in my life that I've just been so fortunate to know.
Mm-hmm. So let's pause on just this kind of the practical feature of what you've just described. The friendship aspect is, I mean, it's essential, obviously. And that's what sustains good scholarship. That's what sustains the academy, I think, is genuine and trusting friendship where you can trust your ideas with people. I'm curious, though, when you would receive either from, you know, Laura Nasrallah or Karen King or from your friend Michelle, when you would receive a paperback from them and you'd see the marks in the side, the margin, how would you let that be like a real learning moment? Because I feel like for me, my insecurities tempt me to basically just be like, okay, I'm just going to click accept all changes and assume that they were right about everything. And I wrote something atrocious and they fixed it. So that's great news. So like, how do you respond to that and take it as a learning experience and grow from it?
You know, kind of like you, part of it was an accept all, but I knew if I just accepted all, I wouldn't learn anything.
Yeah.
Right. So I needed to go over them and figure out the patterns which I had fallen into, which they were picking up on, or at least the patterns of what they were noticing in my writing that are moves that I could change and not elicit that kind of attention.
Yeah.
But because it was based in friendship and respect, and it's really admiration in terms of my advisors, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, there wasn't that sting perchance, right?
Yeah.
Rather, I wholeheartedly took it and thought, okay, they're seeing something. Where do I go? And especially when you're writing your dissertation, you're trying to move on to the next thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're I'm trying to figure out the adjective. I don't know if it's militaristic, but you just think, okay, this is what I have to do, right? I'm going to go step, get done. So I didn't almost even leave room for all my emotions. I just said, okay, I got to learn this. I need to be better. And we need to complete this dissertation. Because as they say, there are no good dissertations or bad dissertations. There are complete dissertations and incomplete dissertations. But fortunately, my dissertation was good enough to warrant the attention of Baylor University Press.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. These folks helped you to improve stylistically, to grow and mature as a writer. How, at this point in your career, would you describe stylish writing, good academic style?
So I think about style, you know, the memory and story that comes to my mind is sitting in a doctoral cohort meeting with being led that moment by Karen King and her walking us through this book called Style. And in fact, I have it right here. Style by Joseph Williams and Joseph Bizup. The subtitle is Lessons in Clarity and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done, you know, Sunk's Elements of Style and other works, but I found this piece to be really helpful. And in particular, the chapter on concision stuck with me. And the beauty of concision. I never thought of concision as poetic and beautiful, but it really is, especially in kind of our culture, which is struggles to maintain attention and focus, right? To be able to say something concisely, precisely, and poetically is more powerful than ever to maintain somebody's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Karen telling us, you know, that chapter in particular changed her own life. And as a result, she went through her writing and noticed that she could at least delete about 20%, 25% of anything she wrote and make it that much stronger, because so much of what she wrote, for example, had throat clearers, right?
Yeah.
You know, these things that we say to set up. Well, it's significant that, or it's important that you notice this.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these are good statements to say, but oftentimes they're kind of this long wind-up pitch, right? Or this, right? Because for whatever reason, right, we want, you know, so sometimes, I mean, it's important because it's meant to capture the reader's attention. Sometimes, and I'm going to be honest as a human here, right? Like, I want you to think I'm a big scholar with my big boy scholar pants on. So I'm going to use these big phrases I see in other scholarly texts to underline the importance of this coming statement, right? So a lot of the times those statements aren't needed and you can just get directly to the point. You know, the chapter also talks about, you know, oftentimes we use these phrases that have double synonyms, like that mean the same thing. Now I'm trying to think of some of these.
Yeah.
I can actually, you know, give examples of what they use, like full and complete, or true and accurate, or hopes and desires, each and every, first and foremost, right? You don't need all those words just to say desires or foremost, right? Or, you know, the rule of three, oftentimes we'll use three words to say the one thing we need to see. So
it's a magic number.
It's a magic number. So that has helped my writing. And honestly, again, too, I know this is not my therapy couch, but, you know, when I think about style and I think about, you know, what makes good writing, you know, there are certain rules I go to, but I honestly think sometimes my own writing is actually reflected or is informed by what's going on internally in me. Mm-hmm. And one of the internal things in me is this insecurity that generally people don't want to listen to me. Yet I'm on a podcast and this is like my third podcast. So
yes, people do want to listen to you as it turns out.
People keep inviting me for some reason. But that if I'm going to take someone's attention, I better make sure that every sentence is worth that person's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I ought not to say too much more than that.
Yeah.
And how do I get to my next point, into the next piece of substance or my next piece of evidence?
Yeah.
And move things along that way. And then when it's said, move on to the next thing.
Right.
And that will honor the person's time. It will honor my time. And we'll get on with our lives and our parenting and other things.
Right.
So that, again, ties into concision. But it also, I think, has helped me to really be strategic with the words, with my word count and my structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think concision is, I mean, boy, it is a sometimes daunting task to look at a first draft and to realize how much you've written as an exercise in learning what you think. And that, for me at least, leads to a lot of convoluted sentences that kind of move and get tied up in knots. and they need to be untangled. I think Dr. Alicia Myers used that metaphor too, talking about her own writing. And one of the most challenging things that I think is a kind of a custom in biblical studies, at least academic writing, is to kind of, you lose concision because we read so many essays and articles and books that try to take away the author's agency. And so they write in these awkward passive constructions. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of Dave Nelson was on the podcast not long ago talking about how as an editor and as the director of Baylor Press, he would really appreciate if more authors would take writing into the active voice as often as possible. It's more direct, there's more agency there. And that's also been kind of instructed by Helen Sword, who wrote the book Stylish Academic Writing that I've been reading recently. And so I guess, yeah, I'm resonating with what you're talking about with concision. And I think that it's related to how academic writing so often tries to veil who's thinking, who's making an argument. And I think that the activeness of writing is for me something that I'm learning more and more can be a good feature, an important feature of good academic writing.
Absolutely. And that actually leads to my next point that I've been thinking a lot about my writing is to reintroduce characters and subjects into my sentences.
Yeah.
Right? Because we oftentimes write sentences in academia with, you know, with technical terms or abstract nouns in this passive voice, in these elongated sentences to convey our meaning, because whether it's to remove agency of the author in there or that we're thinking with ideas, but you know, try to first and foremost forefront verbs, right? And action items that move sentences along.
Yeah.
And I it's sometimes hard to do when you're talking about technical terms, but I try to, and this right ties into my third point, right? Is when you have verbs and you have characters, you also have the potential to reintroduce story or some elements of narrative in whatever you are describing or explaining or detailing to the audience.
Yeah.
And this is something I've been thinking a lot about in my capacity and in my relationship of being the director of graduate studies for Nates and Indigenous community and working with Indigenous communities and thinking about Indigenous languages. You know, as I've been interviewing people for this book on Indigenous interpretations of the Bible within this community, one of the things that keeps coming up is the need to restorify or to bring back narrative and story to theology along those lines, right? That this ties in with Indigenous languages, which are very verb heavy, right? Yeah. They don't have all the technical terms and nouns that that's predominant in you know, English, which is my first language, right? But that things are described as in present action and in relationship in terms of verbs, and just how compelling that is. And and so going back to my writing again, I think I know I at least am more captivated as an audience, as a reader, when I see things that are moving things along with clearly identifiable verbs that are at the front of the sentence that are moving the action along and that clearly show who's doing what to whom. Because in a passive voice, then that sometimes gets lost or the sentence gets elongated, or you just the amount of ease you can create for your reader, especially when you are describing complex ideas or new information, will, you know, is the sugar that helps the medicine go down, right?
Nice. This is a great reference. My kids have been watching Mary Poppins a lot lately, and sometimes you do need a spoonful of sugar. Yeah.
You absolutely you do. And I don't know too, like, especially if I'm like half engaged in a reading, right? Mm-hmm. Like I want it to, I want it to be beautiful and poetic. That's what's going to keep me engaged. Because we read so much in the academy. We read so much mediocre writing too, mm-hmm. that like it almost just kind of annoys you. And so like it's a real treat when you read something beautiful. This kind of ties into the how. I want to lift up again one of my doctoral advisors, Laura Nasrallah, who at the very beginning is a great writer, but she recently published a book on the archaeology of Paul's letters. Mm. And if you haven't read it, it is beautiful. It is some of her most poetic historical nonfiction writing yet. And she notes in the preface, thanks to Sarah Porter, who's a wonderful recent graduate from the program. And the ways in which Sarah, as a research assistant, introduced poetry into her life. Mm-hmm. And was constantly together reading poetry week by week here, it seems like, or at least in some regular schedule. And having been her research assistant for a previous book that she wrote on, just the martyr and others in the first century or second century Christian culture of seeing the visualization of images and such, just her writing, her prose were on a whole nother level.
Yeah.
And I think that ties into, right? If you consume, you are what you eat, right? You are what mm-hmm. you read. If you consume and you read beautiful texts and poetry, I just can't help but imagine that will have some also impact on your aesthetics of style when it comes to your writing.
Yeah, that seems totally right. You're listening to Currents in Religion, and we are talking with Christopher Hakletabi. I'm thinking too, just back to your references to more active language, more action, moving things along, but also you've kind of alluded to the need to help readers, especially when we're trying to describe or articulate or work with abstract ideas. And I'm just keep talking about Helen Sword, but it's because I've just read her book, and one of her primary kind of final exhortations to academic writers is be concrete, use examples from daily life, from the world, that people can just get it, to bring abstract ideas into focus. I feel like there is a tension here with the earlier comments about concision, something that Helen Sword also says we need to be, but at the same time, not at the cost of being vague. And I think I'm intrigued by that need for more concrete, like real life sorts of analogies or metaphors that can help readers just kind of hang, you know, if we go on for too long. And that might be a bit more helpful for certain fields that tend towards a greater degree of abstraction than maybe some biblical scholars do. But I take that as a kind of convicting word for my own writing that I could do better at giving people anchors and footholds in concrete ways.
No, absolutely. You know, also as you were saying that, I recalled another story I thought would be good to bring that is very Baylor centric. And it's actually when I first brought my dissertation to Carrie Newman. I met Carrie Newman at Louisville Institute gathering for postdoctoral fellows, and he was giving a short discussion on how do you take your dissertation and sell it as a book? How do you talk to publishers, and what's your 5-minute speech? And so over coffee break, I was like, hey, Carrie, so you gave us the framework for 5-minute speech. Do you mind if I test out my 5-minute speech on you? And he's like, all right, let's go for it. So I gave him the elevator speech for my dissertation. He's like, send it to me today. All right. And it was fantastic. And that was a match made in heaven. And from there, he looked over that night and said, I'd love to publish this and cancel all your other conversations with other publishers. And, you know, so when we began working on this, the project, which was my book, I was so excited and so proud of my dear introduction, where I did this history of scholarship on how people have been talking about the term piety in New Testament studies, pietas in Latin and eusebia in Greek. And I thought I really made a contribution to this, extending it out. And he's like, yeah, I cut all that. Like, that's not interesting to anybody.
Oh, no.
And I just was such a heartache. I was like, oh, but pray at least have it as appendix, because I see that you did, you know, you allowed Richard Bauckham to have, you know, this in an appendix. And he's like, no. I'm sorry, not the Bauckham, Larry Hurtado, because he had wrote this book on, Christians Amongst the Gods or something.
Sure.
And I was going to be a spiritual cousin to that book. But he's like, you know, but for this introduction, I want you to tell me a fairy tale. Tell me a fairy tale about the story of your book.
Yeah.
What is the setting? Who are the protagonists? What is the problem? What are the stakes?
Mm-hmm.
And I just went home thinking, gosh, this is such a stupid idea. What am I going to do with this? Right? Like, no one's ever asked me this. Yeah. And I worked on it and I thought, oh my gosh, this is brilliant.
Uh-huh.
And I sent it to him. He said, that's your new introduction. And it may have been like one more draft as he tried again, but you know,
sure,
it didn't take me long. And he said, this is your introduction. And I loved it.
Yeah.
And again, this is tying in with, again, Nate, and even just thinking about the human condition more, is that like, we are people of story,
mm-hmm,
right? And this is why so many people get turned away from academia, because we get in the weeds and the details, and we're talking about technical terms and all these abstract things, right? And the reader gets lost when they lose the plot of the story. They lose the stakes of the argument and the investigation, right?
Yeah.
It's like Sherlock Holmes, and you're spending hours on this fingernail, and you're piecing all together, and you're like, what is this going to solve, right? Well, let me bring you back to this mystery that we're trying to figure out. Here are the stakes again. And this, again, ties into any good writing, right? You need to tie people back to the larger argument. Or if you're going to go down into the weeds, you need to make sure you come back up for breath again.
Right.
And again, it's always that balance of reminding people what the story is, but not so repetitive that, you know, it's boring, or that so much of your chunk is constantly retracing stuff that's happened before.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember my advisors constantly reminding me, you know, remind people of what you're doing at the very beginning, at the end. I mean, this is a pretty basic advice, but there are more poetic ways of doing it than others.
Yeah.
And ultimately, again, your reader is going to help you know that.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that I would love to get across to people too, that I think was also most inspiring for me, was that like, no great book is an island.
Mm-hmm.
That it's one person's name on the book, but look at the preface, look at the acknowledgement, look at that cloud of witnesses of people, mm-hmm, who've come along and were midwives to that book.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you'll have an editor, you know, hanging in the wings there too.
Mm-hmm.
But that every great piece of writing is, there's a village around it that has helped to constructively build that artwork together. And it's,
yeah,
through their notes and through their intuitions and through their feel of things that have helped to build that art piece and that experience that is your book and your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, before I would just get very self-conscious, start writing like, oh, but is this good, what this person's going to say or whatever, you know, it can be crippling. But you know, I'm very much in the market of write shitty first drafts, right? Just,
yeah,
get it out there and then edit it again, mm-hmm, and then send it off to people whose tastes, whose aesthetics you respect, right? Who are beautiful minds, and they will help you feel out your work, right?
Yeah.
And eventually you'll have your own style. I think I have and know my voice better than I did as a doctoral student now. And you'll develop that, but you know, just the advice I'd give to young graduate students, right, is trust in the process, trust in your peers and trust in your advisors, that it's not all on you to all of a sudden come up with this perfect prose. And even when I thought my dissertation was beautiful insofar as it, you know, Michelle, Karen and Laura had all looked at it, right, and had been, mm-hmm, been great, then Carrie looked on it. And then the editor at Baylor looked at it, right? And then someone, yeah, else looked at it as well, right? And all that came to be like, oh, look, this book that has beautiful style, it has substance, right? So it's, mm-hmm, like, yes, you can interview me, right? But I am, you know, just a representative, or really what my book is, right? It's it's me, but it's also this cloud of witness. This community that's come around me. And I would be misleading to the process, right? I'd be more mystifying of the process if I just claimed is like, well, here are the four steps that I just did that, you know, me and my brilliant self made this great work.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for that. That's a good encouragement and reminder that the writing process is itself communal, in a really good way. That's not a problem. That's a good thing. Any additional resources or wisdom that you'd like to share with those of us who would like to continue learning from you about improving our writing?
Gosh, well, I mean, in terms of resources, I think we've already named some of the best ones, right? Between Style, Lessons for Clarity and Grace, and Helen's Swordwork, which you referenced. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fantastic piece. To read those is, you know, again, a great start, a great reference. Spend time doing the exercises again. It's you know, it's funny because you can spend time like creating this rubric of what style is, right? Mm-hmm. And getting things together. I think back to one of my friends at Andover Newton, who's an Old Testament professor, Greg Mobley, right? He's like, oh man, all these rubrics like about like what a B paper is, you just kind of like feel what a B paper is. You know what I mean? When you're grading, you just know. Mm-hmm. Why do I have to give all this like other information about it, right? Yeah. It's just a B paper. I know it when I see it, right? Rubrics are good, but I think there is something instinctually true to what Greg said about that. I think that goes with style. Mm-hmm. Yes, we pay for books to, you know, about style, and I'm cheating the system, but it's style is somewhat artistic beauty. Yeah. And I think beauty and definitions of beauty are determined by communities. Mm-hmm. And like any discourse, right, that's setting the rules of like, or any kind of idea of style, right? We keep talking about what's stylish. It's like, goodness knows, my wife can tell you, I don't know what stylish clothes are, right? I have certain hints I've picked up based on what people have said or commented or said that looks good in my life, right? It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, Chris, determine what your style, how did you develop your style? It was like, people made fun of me for wearing this. And then I wore this and people stopped making fun of me, right? And I think that's true with writing. So mm-hmm. like, I don't want to like just give a list of rules.
Of course.
I mean, you're certainly not listening to a podcast with your note paper in hand, right? So I want to give you things that you can maybe imagine yourself doing right now. And that is, again, I'm going to sound like a broken record at like this, but trust in the relationships you have and be intentional about cultivating mm-hmm. Communities of beautiful writers that you trust to help you determine and be thoughtful about taking notes when you get your stuff back, right? Yeah. We actually talk about that in even the undergrad institute I have, like how little our undergrad students actually read our notes when we write about like, this is what you should do to become a stronger writer, right? Most of them just say, oh, I got a B or an A and let it go.
Right.
But if you're lucky enough to have an advisor who takes the time to write notes on anything you read or you've written for them, study them, right? Not just study for what you got right or wrong or why you got a B or A or C, right? But study them for how they might improve your writing and your style.
Great advice. Dr. Haklo Tubby, thank you so much for joining us today on Currents in Religion.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having this conversation. It's important.
I hope you found these conversations helpful for your own writing. And if you did, please share this episode with friends and colleagues who might benefit from it too. Next week, we'll hear from a couple of scholars who ask whether the Apostle Paul can help us live faithfully in our current state of climate crisis. Subscribe so you don't miss that episode when it comes out next week. Until then, take care.